to this new session of Memcast. We're delighted to be joined today by Dr. Daniel Patton once again, and we're going to carry on from where we left out at our recent podcast and continue to discuss medical research in a more practical way as to hopefully get you guys a bit more accustomed to certain terms. And we're going to end with a hierarchy of clinical studies and how would you interpret them. So, hi Dan.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So, should we start off by you telling us roughly how medical research works?
Yeah, so whenever you think about medical research, it's always to kind of answer a question, to try to answer, for example, does a treatment work for a patient who's ill? The answer to that is much harder than what you might think. For example, if you wondered whether a drug would be effective for patients with heart failure, maybe the most straightforward way to do that is just to give them the drug, right? But if you think about it, if you've just given one person that drug and the patient gets better, it doesn't necessarily mean that the patient gets better because of the drug, because naturally the patient might have gotten better anyway. So the question then becomes, how do you know for sure that the drug you've given the patient is the reason for why that person's improved? And that's why we have research and clinical research, because the idea of research is to not absolutely prove, but make you more confident that what you're doing is actually beneficial for patients. So the way this works is that basically we have to go all the way back, right? So the idea would be you have to start off with some sort of theory or hypothesis. But in clinical research, we always approach it from the opposite way. We approach it from a null hypothesis. And the reason why we do this is actually very philosophical. It came from the ancient Greeks, and it was originally proposed by Plato. So there's an allegory of Plato's cave. And basically what Plato says is that there is one universal truth, right? So for example, this drug works. But because we're human beings, and because we live in a world of chaos, you will never actually ever know for sure the truth. The truth is there, but you'll never, no matter how hard you try, you'll never actually get to the truth. So instead, what you should do is try and disprove the truth. And if you try really, really hard and you can't disprove the truth, no matter what you do, then that truth is more likely to be actually true. Right? So that's what Plato's kind of theory comes from. And so that sounds almost like a double negative. And the Plato's cave allegory is basically, imagine you're in a cave and there is a statue, but you can't see the statue. All you can see is the reflection of the statue from a fire. That's all you can see. You can't actually see the statue behind you. You have to constantly make deductions about what the statue looks like, which is the truth, from the shadows on the wall. So that's what you're trying to do in research, right? You never actually get down to the truth, just like how there's no such thing as a perfect study. But you're using the studies to try and kind of make logical deductions about what's more likely to be real and what's less likely to be real. And the reason why we do this, the usefulness of this, means that then you can actually use mathematics to try and give you a probability of whether something is actually true or not. So the reason why this philosophical approach is useful is because it allows us to employ mathematics within our studies.
And how do we do that in practical terms? So tell us more about statistics, I think, because that's where this leads to.
Yes, exactly. So if you were to basically say, for example, I want to see if this drug improves patients' mortality if they have heart failure, you start with the null hypothesis, right? So you start off with the null hypothesis, which is that this drug is not useful. And then you start kind of designing the kinds of studies that you would do to try and see if that's the case or not, right? Now, when you're doing this, when you employ statistical tests, there's a very important value, which is called the p-value. And the p-value is a probability value, which goes from zero, and it can only go up to one, it can't be more than one. Or it can be interpreted as 0% or 100%. Now, remember what I said about you can never find the truth. So a p-value can never be one, or it can never be 100%, because you never know the truth, right? And it can never be zero. It can only be somewhere in between those values. Now, we won't talk about it today, but the way you generate a p-value is using mathematics and using specific statistical tests to look at what's going on. But this part is really important, and it's what the definition of the p-value is. And I think often clinicians get this wrong. So clinicians often interpret the p-value wrong. So I'll give you some examples first of what the p-value isn't, right? So the p-value isn't how likely something is to be true. That is the most common kind of misnomer, right? Because if you think about it, we say a p-value of less than 0.05 is significant, right? So if p-value of less than 0.05 is significant, then you're saying there's a 4% chance that this is true, or 5% chance, less than 5% chance that this is true, which is not what you're looking at. It doesn't make sense, right? So it's not the right way to think about it. The second kind of misunderstanding that people have is how strongly something is related to something else. The p-value doesn't tell you that. The p-value doesn't tell you whether, you know, how, like, if one thing increases by a certain amount, like if you give X amount of drug, the person will improve by this much. But that's not how, this doesn't give you a strength, okay? So the p-value actually comes back from this double negative approach, the null hypothesis that we talked about, right? And that's why it's important. So the p-value is actually the probability that the null hypothesis is true. And that's just the way the mathematics works. That's why we employ mathematics, because it can give you this p-value. And the reason why we say a p-value of less than 0.05 is significant, because let's say that you get a p-value of 0.04, it's a 4% chance that this drug doesn't improve mortality in patients with heart failure. And therefore, there's a 96% chance that it does. And therefore, because you've tried to disprove it and you find that you can't really because of the 4%, it's more likely to be true. You can't be sure. It's important to understand this. You can't be sure 100%, right, that this drug will improve, but you're pretty sure based on the statistical test that you've done. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does, but I think people generally don't tend to think of it that way. So we've spoken about p-value. So it's important because I think every one of us reads clinical studies, and it's important to know what the p-value actually is.
Yeah. And I guess another, just to kind of extend from that, another useful way of thinking about the p-value is that if you did this experiment 100 times, right, how many times does it give you the same finding? Right. So a p-value of 0.04 would mean that, you know, if you did this experiment 100 times, 4 times the drug wouldn't improve patients with heart failure, but 96 times it does, right? So again, that's why we use the statistics. That's the way to think about it. The idea being that it's not one or zero, it's always somewhere in between. There's always a continuum. That's the first thing. And then the second thing to think about when kind of thinking about the p-value is it's really important not to dismiss everything above 0.05 as useless, or everything below 0.05 as useful, right? Because it's an arbitrary cutoff that we've just used in clinical medicine to decide. If I give you an example, tomorrow there's a 4% chance it will rain, and the day after there's a 6% chance it will rain, you probably won't bring an umbrella to work on both days, right? The 5% is just an arbitrary cutoff. So when you interpret a study, especially a very early phase study, it's important to look at what the actual p-value is rather than decide on the cutoff, right? Because a p-value of 0.2 means that there's a 20% chance that this drug won't improve patients' mortality, but there's an 80% chance that it might do. So it doesn't mean it's not important. You know, it might mean there's a whole range of other factors. It might be underpowered study. It might just be a very early study. So that's why it's really important to really understand what the p-value means.
Then when we talk about statistical significance, do we only refer to p-value, and what sort of p-value actually does give our study statistical significance then?
Well, that's a really good question. And the really thing that we have to think about here is what we actually mean by statistical significance, right? So what a p-value does, it tells you whether one thing is related to another. What it doesn't do is tell you whether one thing causes another. So for example, if you gave this drug to people with heart failure, how do you know for sure? Again, is this question about how do you know it's due to the drug, right? It depends, this is where the hierarchy of study comes in, because it depends on how you've collected the data to do your statistical test. If you've just randomly, now we can talk about it from the evidence hierarchy, actually. So if you just gave one person the drug and they improved, you can't do any statistics on that because the number is only one. But that is a case report. And as we discussed before, a case report, or maybe multiple people, case series, is lowest on the evidence hierarchy for causation, i.e. not looking at association, but whether one thing causes another, because you can't really tell. From an N of one, you don't really know. You could, it's useful to kind of explore hypotheses, right? It's useful if it's the first time that's happened, or it's something that's quite interesting, which might influence the conduct of future studies. Now, the next step from that is, let's say you've just come to work one day and you've just decided to collect data on everyone who received the drug versus everyone who haven't received the drug and look at whether they were dead or alive. You did that on one day, that is a cross-sectional study. So you've just done it at one point in time. Now, the problem with that, even if you find that there is an important statistical relationship between the drug and people who were dead or alive, is that you only did it across one point in time. And the people who receive that drug may be younger, with less comorbidities, or don't smoke, right? Compared to the people who didn't receive the drug. So the people who didn't receive the drug were older compared to the people who received the drug. This is what we call confounders, right? So in a cross-sectional study, you can deduce correlation, but there might be lots of confounders in that data. That means that you can't know for sure it's the drug that's actually improved the life of the patient. The next step for that is to do a cohort study or a case control study. Now, with a case control, what you do is you have people who have died and you have people who haven't died within, you know, a given period of time. And you go back and you see how many people who died received this drug and didn't receive this drug. And you compare it to the people who didn't die and how many people received the drug and who didn't receive the drug. And you see if there's a significant difference between these two groups. That's quite strong because it's giving you the element of time, right? Because you're looking at people who died and you're looking at people who are alive and you're going backwards in time to see whether something's happened, whether these people received the drugs or not. But the problem with the case control study is that it really depends on where you're getting your data from, because it's retrospective. These people have already died, or they're already alive. So you cannot control the quality of the data that you get. Like, for example, people might give different brands of the same drug when you're going back. Some people might not have recorded the drug on the drug chart, although they received it, you know, the electronic drug chart. So it's not an accurate marker. With a cohort study, what you can do is you can have a group of people with heart failure that you're following up prospectively in a hospital, and you are actively collecting their data, and you see whether they die or not, right, after receiving this drug. And the beauty of a cohort study is that you can follow them up for a really long period of time. So, you know, it doesn't have to be in hospital mortality. It can be maybe 5-year or 10-year mortality if you have, you know, the will to conduct a study for that long. And so, because it's prospective and you're following these people up over time, it will give you a much more accurate marker of whether something is related to something. And because of that time aspect, it also means that there's a strong degree of causation, which means that it's more likely that the drug is actually causing the outcome. So that's why that hierarchy exists, right? So you've got at the bottom, you've got the case control, case series, followed by the cross-sectional, and then followed by a case control, and then followed by a cohort. Now, there's still a problem with all these studies, right? And I kind of alluded to it with what I said. The two main things, right, is confounding and bias, right? So confounding is what I meant, is that maybe the people who receive the drug are just different in their other characteristics compared to people who didn't receive the drug. The thing that we can do with statistics is that you can actually adjust for confounders using statistical tests after you've collected the data. So there is a way, for example, that we can see whether the drug has caused someone to more likely to survive or not, taking into account age and comorbidities. However, that depends on whether you've actually collected data on those confounders. And there's an argument here that basically it's impossible to collect all the possible confounders in a data set, right? Like, there's infinite amounts of things that you haven't thought of. with bias. Now, bias is something that you cannot control for in your study. It's just the way that you've collected the data. It's something inherent in the data that you cannot change. All studies that I've described so far are prone to bias. And what I mean, and there's often different kinds of bias, but you know, one thing I mentioned was that, you know, with a case control, it depends on how well the data is collected prior to when you look back at these retrospectively. That's information bias, right? Another thing that could be a bias would be that if you were collecting data on your hospitalized patients. So if you collect data on hospitalized patients, by definition, they're already kind of sick. And so maybe your results don't apply to everyone with heart failure and only the small proportion of people who are hospitalized with heart failure. And that's another kind of bias, that's a sampling bias. Right? So these studies are all very prone to bias, and therefore that's why they're not at the top of the evidence pyramid. Because of confounding and bias, these studies mean that you cannot absolutely interpret generally causation from these studies. You can only really deduce the strength of association from these studies.
And what's on the top of the evidence-based? We haven't mentioned things like meta-analysis or statistical analysis. What's the difference between the previous studies you mentioned and the meta-analysis, for example?
Well, so before I get there, so yes. In my opinion, the top of the pyramid would be randomized controlled trials.
Okay.
But that's a very good question, and I'll come back to why I don't think meta-analysis is necessarily the top.
Okay.
So the beauty of a randomized controlled trial is in its name. Right. So randomized control at the top of the pyramid for causation because they are randomized and they are controlled. Why is that good? Well, randomizing control gets rid of confounding and bias. So by having randomization occurring, what you're basically saying is you've got a patient who comes to you in clinic, you do not know what they're going to get, whether they're going to get the actual treatment or something else, right? So you roll a dice. And through the dice, or it's actually much more complex, but yeah, you decide through a complex kind of truly randomization process whether this patient's going to get randomized to the actual treatment or something else. And because you're randomizing people to intervention group, which is your drug, and your control group, which is your fake drug, it means that you should have roughly, especially if you've got enough people in your trial, equal numbers of people in each group that have the same confounders, even the confounders that you never thought of. That's the beauty of true randomization. It gets rid of confounding because there should be an equal number of confounding in your true intervention group and your placebo group. Now, the control group also does another thing. By having a control, it means that you are only comparing people from your treatment to people who didn't receive treatment in that group. And therefore, it gets rid of the majority of biases that occurs in studies. Because the problem with bias is that you cannot really generalize whether your study's findings actually apply to everyone, or even to the people in your group. But if you have a control group, you've got, going forwards, a group that you're actually comparing to the intervention. And that gets rid of all the other bias that often occurs. And so it makes you far more confident that if there's a significant association, if your trial is well conducted, that drug is actually the reason for why that outcome occurs.
Okay.
So that's why it's top in the causation. And this evidence paper is really important. It's not about the strength of association. It's how likely it is one thing causes another thing. Now, systematic reason meta-analysis is very interesting because the argument that systematic reason meta-analyses trump randomized control trials is because it's got far more numbers, right? And it gathers information from all studies. But a meta-analysis is only as good as the studies it's included. So if you've done a meta-analysis of cohort studies, my argument is that actually a randomized control trial would be better, because even if you have larger numbers, you haven't got rid of confounding, you haven't got rid of bias. But if you have a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials, now that is better than a single trial because you've got more numbers of a much well-designed study to look at causation. Now, the final thing I want to say is that just because randomized controlled trials are the top and case series is the bottom, it's just the strength of causation, right? It's not got anything to do with whether one study is better than another. Randomized controls are great, but they are super expensive to do. they take a lot of resources, and therefore it's really difficult for randomized controlled trials to look at long-term outcomes, right? You cannot do a randomized controlled trial, or as far as I know, you can't do it for 10 years, right? It just doesn't work like that. And so different kinds of studies are actually the best trial design or study design to answer different kinds of questions. And that's really important to bear in mind. It's not that one study is better than another. So when you read a paper, the first question you have to ask is this the kind of study that's best designed to even answer this question? Right? And the answer isn't always a trial. So it just depends on what is important. Yeah.
Yes, so we've gone through a lot, actually. So we've discussed how research works, a bit about statistics, p-values, the difference between causation and correlation. I think we've approached that and we've discussed it, and also the hierarchy of studies. So I think we can conclude the podcast, but to summarize, obviously most of the people listening to us are IMTs or doctors that have just started to get involved in medical research or read medical research. So what would be your tips for someone that reads an article of medical research, a clinical study? From what you've told them today, is it important to just understand the difference between the clinical studies and the importance with regards to the topic that the article is and the study is actually trying to cover? So what do you think they should be looking at?
I think the first thing to really answer with that is you have to treat clinical studies with caution, because it's different to before, right? These days, you could probably find some sort of academic paper that argues for an argument that you're thinking about in the literature. Yeah. Because that is just how there's so much research now. There's always a paper almost on every topic which supports an argument one way and supports an argument the other way, especially with regards to clinical decisions. And this is why the hierarchy of evidence is really important, because some studies will actually support your clinical decision making better than others. So it's really important, if you're approaching it from a clinician and you're looking at the literature to try and answer, for example, a specific clinical question that you have, is to look at, you know, what's the strength of causation? Is this study the right study design to answer the real research question? And then I think the importance with a study is that it's not going to be a riveting read, right? There's no need as a clinician perhaps to read the entire paper unless you are just interested in the paper, right? You can probably skip the introduction and you could probably even skip the discussion, right? What you should look at with a clinical paper really is the results, what the results show. I often just go straight to the tables and the graphs, and a good paper, you should be able to basically see what the messages are from the main tables and graphs, and then go back on and read the results, and then ensure the methodology to get to those results is something you're happy with. Then I read the methods, right? And just from the methods and results, you should be able to actually answer that clinical question you have based on just looking at that data. And of course, you've got to read lots of papers. So the more papers you read, the easier this becomes. So in summary, the trick is to not read the entire paper, basically to develop a set of skills where you can quickly extract the information that you think is the most important from the data. And just be aware that basically there is a paper to kind of address every single clinical question, and there's an argument both sides, which is why you need to really understand the strength and actually make sure that study is exactly what you're looking for.
Great, thank you. That was extremely useful, as usual. Thank you for joining us today. And hopefully we can meet in the future and go more deeply into statistics and just try to make it more understandable and easier to access for lots of our listeners. So thank you, Dan, again. Thank you for joining us, and thank you guys for joining us today, and join us again next week for a new episode.